political history in the Age of Reason. The Enlightenment, the 17th and 18th centuries. Two chapters, one on absolutism, the other on reactions to absolutism, which took the form of revolutions. It may be said there are four revolutions. You will see three in the next chapter, and the running start was found in today's lesson with the restraint of absolutism exercised in England. The so-called Glorious Revolution in England was the beginning of a movement at the end of the 17th century, which was accelerated and geographically dispersed throughout much of the 18th century. In the 18th century, we're going to see the War of Independence in the United States, in the American colonies, which resulted in the establishment of the United States of America. Some prefer to refer to this as the War of Independence rather than the American Revolution. Two points of view. The result of both was the same, the establishment of the United States of America. This is followed by the French Revolution. Clearly a revolution, unqualifiedly destructive in its character, and not at all the cradle of liberty. A greater tyranny was established by the so-called French Republic in the 1790s, and still greater by the work of Napoleon, a greater tyranny, a greater absolutist government. Napoleon was the inheritor of the fruits of the French Revolution, the French Revolution. And as such, he was a new kind of monarch, autocrat, one-man ruler, self-asserted sovereign. A third set of revolutions in that next chapter is the Latin American Wars of Independence, establishing a number of fragile republics, asserting their liberty from Spain. Now the running start, I say, for those three revolutions in the next chapter is the Glorious Revolution, so-called, in late 17th century England. Most of 17th century European history is absolutism, and it is that focus that we make today. You have a discussion of France and of England, and a preliminary survey of Russia. Then for next time, the emergence of other absolutist states in the form of Prussia and Austria, and then the conflicts among these states in the wars of power politics. So your assignment for next time sees the competition among these absolutist states, particularly in the eastern part of Europe, Prussia, Austria, Russia, who battle it out for territory, for prestige, for influence, for station, prominence. And as a result, we see the exercise of the Machiavellian principle that might makes right. With that introduction, let's observe the age of absolutism. In this 17th century, we see a realignment and a new emergence of nations. I've listed four revolutions. I've asserted the difference between the 17th century and the 18th century. The 18th century is going to be a century of revolutions. The 17th century is a century of absolutism. Now, this absolutism is a concept, a theory, a principle. We will look first, then, at the essence of absolutism. What we're talking about is a situation of rule in which the monarch assumes power in every realm of the land, in every area of the life of his subjects. The monarch is sovereign. It's obvious that that means politically he's in charge. He decides what is lawful and what is unlawful. But it means much more than that, for it extends to economics, it extends to religion, it extends to the arts. How often the arts have been employed by the sovereign, the absolute sovereign, as a vehicle of the propaganda of the government's purpose. The art, the drama, the music must all applaud the government, the state. It must be used as propaganda for the monarch's will. I use the word monarch rather than king because in these several different countries there are different titles. King is most common, to be sure, but in the case of Russia, the title was Tsar or Tsar. Tsar, T-S-A-R, coming from the old Roman Caesar. Later in 19th century Germany, early 20th century Germany, the title is going to be Kaiser. Kaiser, which is a literal pronunciation of the Latin word Caesar, which we read Caesar. Caesar. And the Kaiser and the Tsar all are referring to an absolute monarch. Monarch simply means one ruler. Ruler who is one. Rule by one is monarchy. But that one may take a number of different titles in various countries. In the case of France, he is the king. In the case of England, he is the king. But we will see that will not generally be true. There's a realignment of the major nations. I said there's the emergence of new powers, you'll see in the next assignment. We've not talked about Prussia before, not really talked about Austria before. New nations emerging and certain former powers declining. Observe three significant powers in decline. These three in decline at this time are Spain. Spain, because of her having been overtaken by other countries in the race for colonies in the New World, her great success in gold and colonies in the 16th century was overtaken by France, England, and others. A second country in decline is Holland, which had been so commercially prominent. It becomes less so. Now, that's a two-edged statement, however. Toward the end of the assignment, you observe that the head of Holland, the stadtholder, the state holder, the head of state, William of Orange, because he had married the daughter of James II of England, Mary, they came to the throne of England. William and Mary. This Mary is the daughter of James II, who was deposed in the so-called Glorious Revolution. She is properly Mary the Second. Mary the First, whom we never called that, was the daughter, the eldest daughter of Henry VIII in the time of the Reformation. We called her Mary Tudor or Bloody Mary. It was not necessary to refer to her as Mary the First unless or until there was a Mary the Second. And in 1688, there became a Mary the Second and a William the Third. William the Conqueror, back in 1066, became William the First. His elder son was William the Second, and we've not had a William since 1100 until 1688. And then the William that comes to England in 1688 is the head of Holland, the head of the Dutch Republic, Protestant and powerful. But although I just said Holland is in decline, in a sense Holland's chief son assumed the throne of England. So it was a decline which was in effect a greater victory than if Holland herself had continued prominent. A third country in decline at this time is Sweden. Sweden. And this is evident in the Great Northern War, in which Charles the XII fought against Peter the Great, and in spite of many temporary successes, ultimately was defeated. The Great Northern War, Charles the XII. You recall Gustavus Adolphus at the time of the 30 Years' War, and the near victory which the Swedish king, Gustav Adolf, snatched from the Holy Roman Empire. Some of you remember that from last semester. The times of Sweden's greatness, Sweden's military prowess, were now past and passing. The essence of absolutism is then the idea of one man in power over all areas of life in his land. One man in power over all areas of life in his land, not simply geographic areas, but also cultural areas. So all six, as we speak of them, of the areas of culture, that is political, economic, social, religious, intellectual, and aesthetic. Government, economics, society, thought, art, and religion. Government, economics, and society. Thought, art, and religion. Those are the six. And in each of these, the will of the monarch was to be dominant in the land. This is described very literally in the case of France, in the case of Louis XIV, who set the styles for the crowns of Europe, set the patterns, set the manners, the etiquette, if you will, the polite and proper, the ideal. And other countries sought to imitate the French style. That very idea of France setting the styles, French fashions, came to refer to much more than clothing. It meant the etiquette of court, the proper manner of deporting oneself in the presence of the king and the royal family. It meant the trappings of of nobility. It meant a lavish palace, superfluous expenditure, merely to demonstrate that the king is absolute, and being absolute, the country has nothing to fear. It's a remarkable thing that the Bourbon kings who resided at Versailles, 14 miles outside Paris, who were willing to throw open their doors to the people. The people could come in and out of the Versailles Palace in almost all hours of the day, not quite the night. Many people were on the paths and roadways between Paris and Versailles, coming and going, most of the time. Peasant people and city workers who lived in very poor situations would be welcome to walk through the royal palace. And this was not, this did not have the effect in the 17th century that we would expect it to have. That is, my goodness, the king lives with such wealth and splendor, and I live in squalor. No, it did not have that reaction. The reaction was rather, I'm in a bad way, but my king lives lavishly, so my country must be all right. If my king can live that way, we must be rich and the envy of the rest of Europe. And that's the way it was looked at. Eventually they came to realize that the crown had impoverished the land. Almost everything Louis XIV did cost too much and resulted in weakening his country. The lavishness of display. But while it was going, and until it was found out, it was a tremendous boost for the confidence of the people. We are the center of the universe. All Europe looks to us, we French. We set the pattern, the style, and everybody tries to copy us. Louis XIV well said of himself, and his symbol was the sun, S-U-N, see, the sun king. Now the sun gives forth rays of light and warmth. And others bask in it, but its source is greater than those who enjoy it. The sun, a brilliant gold medallion with rays of gold, rays, actual bars of gold streaming from the sun, is Louis XIV's medallion. It is woven into the ironwork of the gate of the main entrance of the Versailles Palace. You're entering the realm of the Sun King. See? And as all light derives from the sun, as warmth and supply and life derive from the sun, so is this the center of France. And being the center of France, the center of Europe, what did Richelieu conclude as his desire during the reign of his predecessor, Louis XIII? That he, the king, would become first in Europe. But what Richelieu didn't tell Louis XIII was that Richelieu would be first in France. Richelieu actually ran the affairs of the state, but he made his sovereign the first in Europe. The essence of absolutism is that political situation in which one man, one monarch, rules all aspects of life. This principle was supported, authenticated, justified, rationalized, and that's appropriate in the age of reason, both religiously and philosophically. It was justified religiously and philosophically. The justification for the essence of absolutism religiously is the concept of the divine right theory. The theory of divine right of kings. Divine right. The king is king by the grace of God. Therefore, whatever the king does is the will of God, and it is the duty of every subject to obey the will of God. You obey me, and in so doing, you are obeying God. I am the absolute monarch. God has put me in my place. Therefore, you don't obey me, you obey God. And if you want to be seen disobeying God and take the consequences, then disobey me. But woe unto you if you do. It is not my judgment you should fear, it is God's judgment you should fear. This is a nice pattern to gain submission, see. And we have seen it many times in the past. It is the Sumerian ancient priest king. It is the Egyptian pharaoh. It is the Roman emperor. In each of which cases there was a suggestion of divinity in the monarchy. And it was a means of galvanizing, gathering unto oneself the unquestioned submission of his subjects. Jacques Bossuet, churchman, proposes this divine right theory concept. And soon later in England, James the First, who is James the Sixth of Scotland, also proposes this divine right theory and believes that the king is not to surrender his sovereignty to any group of people. And when warned by his English advisors that the people would not conform to this absolutism, James replied, "They shall conform, or I shall harry them out of the land." They will conform, or they will be removed, either in exile or death. Philosophically, the essence of absolutism was justified, was intellectually argued for by Thomas Hobbes and his Leviathan. Thomas Hobbes wrote a book entitled The Leviathan. Leviathan is a great beast, a great monster, a great sea monster. It suggests hugeness of size and tremendous power. Now, he said, the Leviathan is the state. Man in a state of nature. Now, think, class, very important. Distinguish, see the difference between Thomas Hobbes and John Locke. Their positions begin similarly. They proceed differently. Both Thomas Hobbes and John Locke propose that man in his natural state was ungoverned, unruly, and a fearsome, unpredictable anarchist. Man in his nature, in his natural state, is like a beast. Hobbes said, every man is a wolf. Every man toward his neighbor. A wolf is a symbol of fear, terror, grasping, snatching, unreasonable acquisition. Man in his natural state is a wolf, Thomas Hobbes said. And in order for man to be restrained, in order for there to be any kind of peace or order in the civil realm, man must surrender his liberty in the interest of his freedom, his security. He must surrender his liberty to a governor, the king. The authority of the king is ultimately derived from the people, not from God, as in the divine right concept. Thomas Hobbes is saying, the authority of the king derives from the people. The people give their powers to rule themselves to the king. So the king's power is the people's power surrendered, but should not be seen as a loss to the people, but as a gain to them, because they gain security, the confidence that others will not harm them because they're restrained by the king, in return for the surrender of liberty. They gain security in return for the surrender of liberty. That's an important principle. But now, once this surrender is made, it is an irrevocable surrender. It cannot be called back. It is a one-way action. It is not conditional upon the manner in which the king uses the power. However the king uses it, that's the price we pay for the security we desire. Now, at this point, if I may say it and let you catch it, although it's early in the discussion, at this point, John Locke differs from Hobbes. Up to this point, they are very similar. John Locke says, in his treatise of government, of civil government, that there is a contract arranged between ruler and people, and the rights of the people are surrendered to the sovereign conditionally. And whenever either the king or the people break the conditions of the contract is dissolved. The dissolving of the contract became a justification for revolution. So Hobbes is using the principle to justify absolutism. Locke presents it similarly, but ultimately differently, to justify revolution. I am no longer bound by the surrender of my rights to the king when the king does not live up to his obligation to provide security for the people. When he becomes a tyrant, then I am free from the contract. That's a social contract theory. See? That doesn't mean I have to break the contract. It means the contract is broken. That's a fact in law. Whenever either party in a contract breaks the contract is broken. Whenever the contract's terms are violated, the contract is broken. It does not have to be broken. It is broken automatically. If I contract a loan for a mortgage or something, and I contract to pay X dollars each month, when I fail to do that, then that contract is broken. And immediately the whole amount of the loan is due. The loan is called in its entirety, although the lender has agreed to receive it in payments over 30 years, so much a month. But his agreement is broken if I fail to make my payments. And he immediately, on the terms of the contract, calls in the entire amount. Or, I surrender the property. And what I have paid toward it, I lose. Okay. Leviathan. The epitome of absolutism. The epitome, the greatest example, the ideal expression, the best illustration, the epitome of absolutism. This is 17th century France. It is the Bourbons, particularly Louis XIV, although there are three here to review. We have Henry IV, Louis XIII, and Louis XIV. These three prominent Bourbons are our attention at this point, although in the next chapter we go beyond this. Henry IV was the first of the Bourbons. He's the one who restored order after civil war at the end of the 16th century. He's the one who issued the Edict of Nantes to provide religious toleration to the French Protestants, the Huguenots. He died in 1610 after an undistinguished rule, but a very valuable rule, for he restored order and stability after the chaos of civil war. Louis XIII succeeds him, his son, in 1610, and is on the throne for 33 years. Though just a child of 9 when he became king, Louis XIII was therefore under the tutelage and regency of a Roman Catholic cardinal, Richelieu. Jesuit Richelieu, power behind the throne, the king, the ruler, practically, who brought France into the 30 Years' War, as some of you will remember. The 30 Years' War in which France came in on the side of the Protestants, though she was opposing Protestants in France. That German conflict in the Holy Roman Empire, the 30 Years' War, this was pure balance of power, power politics. France wanted to be sure that Germany did not become too strong. So she guaranteed that by tipping the balances in the direction of stability and a degree of power for the Protestant cause in the Germanies. Louis XIII was overshadowed by Richelieu, who died very nearly close to the time the king himself died. But just as nature had provided a successor to Louis XIII, his son, Louis XIV, so did Machiavellianism provide a successor to Richelieu. Richelieu provided a prepared for a successor for his own office in Cardinal Mazarin, who was the power behind the throne of Louis XIV for the years of his minority. During the early years of Louis XIV, now Richelieu really called the shots under Louis XIII and throughout his reign very nearly, while only early in the reign of Louis XIV was the influence of Mazarin. And in 1661, when Louis XIV was himself some 21, 22 years old, Mazarin died and was never replaced. This young lad came at the age of 4 to the throne. He is Louis XIV. 4 years old, he is the king. Obviously, a regent is acting in his behalf at first. But he is on the throne technically until 1715, which if you subtract from 1715, 1643, you get 72 years as monarch. Almost three quarters of a century, Louis XIV was king of France. And during that time, he established a pattern which was not to be equaled for some time. He did three things which were very costly for France. And I think his career is summarized, his significance is summarized in these three most costly actions. Number one, he built Versailles. Now, this, I've told you a moment ago, was a tremendous boost to the morale of the people, but it made the treasury of France go baroque. It is a baroque structure, yes. It is brilliant. It is grand. It is superfluous. It's too much. After all, I said, how many rooms can you sleep in at one time? How many rooms do you need? It is lavish. Even in its empty state today, without the tremendous presence of a court of nobility fawning at the king's presence, and servants running throughout it, and landscape artists and gardeners and menial servants, Louis XIV was so vain that he insisted that everything look fresh and new. All year long, including the dead of winter, there were fresh blooming flowers in the gardens outside the windows of the palace. And they were fresh blooming flowers because every morning, before the king arose, the gardeners had to put out into the open air from the greenhouses where they were grown fresh flowers which would be frozen before the day was over. But everything looked brilliant and fresh and new and in bloom. Louis XIV was blooming all over. And there's a sense in which the Versailles symbolized this brilliance. Baroque structure, and it caused France to go baroque. The second thing he did of great significance is the revoking of the Edict of Nantes. The revocation of the Edict of Nantes, which was the practical occasion for the exiling of thousands of Huguenots. He did not order their exile. He ordered their conformity to the Church of Rome. They were required not to leave the country. They were forbidden to leave the country. And at risk of their lives, as well as the loss of their fortunes, they fled in great numbers. You must appreciate what it means to go into voluntary exile over a matter of conviction concerning personal faith. Exile in early modern history was considered a greater sentence than death. It was a kind of living death. To be forced to leave your land, to leave your estates, to leave the country where you were reared, the country whose language you spoke, and to roam forever as dumb because you could not speak the language of the countries you went to. Especially for adults and people past middle age, the prospect of learning a new language was extremely remote. And it was considered to people who loved country. See, this is almost a fading virtue in our time. People can glibly talk about escaping the draft, fleeing to Canada, and so forth, see. Where a people have a strong sense of nationality, it is a grave sentence to be denied freedom to roam and live and worship in your own land. Now, who were these Huguenots? And the significant answer is that they were an economic backbone of the lands. They were merchants. They were tradesmen. They were the economic stability of the land. They were the middle class, largely the middle class, which is a typical reflection of the stability of society. Where you have in a land a significant middle class, you have a greater degree of social stability. That's true. where you have a great gulf, a gap between the few rich and the many poor, you have a practical setting for social unrest and popular revolution. A great part of the Huguenot movement represented in France a middle, socially and economically stable class. And France was impoverished by the exiling of the Huguenots. France was weakened. Her tax base, you're going to see in the next chapter, was greatly weakened. Peasants could not bear the tax burden that was required to sustain the lavish expenditures of the crown. And as that burden grew more heavy upon the backs of those least able to bear it, the inclination toward revolt was increased.